Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. What happens when people take to the streets to march under the banner of science? How do you sort out the truth from the misconceptions and lies? Is science in danger? And if so, from whom? And while we're at it, what is science? And does it belong to everyone? Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation came together to answer these questions in an event called March for Science or March for Scientism, Understanding the Real Threats to Science in America. The panel discussion included Stephen Meyer, Wesley J. Smith, Jay Richards, and Marlo Lewis. On a handful of episodes, we bring you highlights of the event in bite-sized segments. Today, Director of Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, Wesley J. Smith, and Director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute, Stephen Meyer, discuss how neo-pagan anti-humanism hurts science. Smith will speak first, followed by Dr. Meyer.
Thank you very much. It was a very interesting presentation. My question is, it's very clear, and in fact, many of these activists who will be here in Washington this weekend are increasingly unashamed about admitting that it is a political movement, it is a political ideology, this is what we believe, capitalism needs to be destroyed, and so on and so forth. How many of those ideas have been alluded to today? You've mentioned how the increasing egalitarianism between man and animal, man and plant, in a almost resurgence of the pagan notion of man's relationship to the earth and so forth. How can we fight that and oppose that? How can scientists and non-scientists alike identify and resist that and oppose that to prevent the very awful consequences that are coming down the pipeline in policy and other areas?
The problem with exactly what you've described is that it is anti-human. And I think we need to begin pointing out that a lot of this advocacy is precisely misanthropic and anti-human. And I've got a couple of examples. David Suzuki, who is a very famous Canadian biologist, been around for years. He's a rock star of science. He's done a lot of television. Back in the 70s, he said that human beings are maggots crawling around the earth, defecating on the planet. Now, you might say, well, in the 70s, he was a young radical fellow, and he no longer means it, but he was asked 2 or 3 years ago whether he wanted to take that back, and he specifically refused to do so and said he just wished human beings would stop being human. David Attenborough, the very famous, very capable naturalist who has done so many wonderful natural wildlife documentaries, has called human beings the, quote, scourge on the planet. And he has supported groups that are for radical human depopulation. Now, the most radical population control regimen in the world is China. I was in China in November, and you saw family after family with one kid because of the one-child policy. They've now made it for 2 children, but not because it's people should get what they want and be happy. It's because they're trying to now centrally control what the demographics will be in 20 or 30 years. But even with the forced abortions, with the female infanticide and so forth, China has not managed to reduce the level of population in the country, merely slow its growth. So if you're going to have actual radical human depopulation, it's going to take incredible tyranny. Now, Attenborough and others like him won't go there. They'll say, well, birth control will solve it. No, it won't. Then the question becomes, do we really have that kind of a problem? But the way it's presented is specifically anti-human. I would even say that Jane Goodall, now this is almost heresy, has harmed science. Now, certainly her observations of the chimpanzees was magnificent. But what did she do? Did she just report on what she observed? No. She anthropomorphized the chimps. And that changed the entire way science actually approaches these issues. And I would call her, to some degree, a novelist. And an example would be where she would describe an elderly female chimp coming into a clearing, sitting for a few minutes, and then leaving. And in the way she would write it is she would say the old lady came into the clearing and looked for some shade. She looked around with satisfaction to see that, that the other chimps were gathering food. She created a life, an inner life for the chimpanzees that she couldn't possibly know. And when she moved from observing the chimps and reporting on her observations in a dispassionate way into an anthropomorphizing way for an ideological purpose, that moved outside of science and into something else. So I think the thing that we have to be aware of and people need to understand is when you start having an environmentalism that is so radical that human beings are the cancer on the planet, that's harmful to environmentalism itself. And a proper environmentalism is too important to permit that. I mean, how many people are going to follow a flag that says humans are cancer? I'm not. So we need to stand up for science properly understood and then policies that properly balance the human equation with our obligation as human beings. We're the only moral species in the known universe. Our obligation, our duty to treat the earth properly. I mean, we protected Yellowstone very well, and we didn't say that Old Faithful Geyser was a person. So it certainly can be done. And I think the anti-humanism really needs to be brought out because I think most people are not anti-human.
Can I take a stab at it too? Yeah, the anti-humanism is important. And I think this is ultimately a battle of ideas. And that part of the way to reverse this is to unmask the source of these ideas, because once the unmasking occurs, it becomes more and more apparent to more and more people that they're really not subject to the arguments that are being promulgated as the consensus. For example, the radical animal rights movement, the denial of human exceptionalism, is a logical consequence of a deeper view that there is no qualitative difference between humans and animals because both were produced by the same process of undirected, unguided, materialistic evolution. And we think that the materialistic theories of evolution, neo-Darwinism, and some of the newer ones that are coming along are empirically false. And so to base an ethical theory on an empirically false foundation like that is fallacious and no way to run the country in terms of ethical judgments and policy statements. So these ideas have connections. And basically what we see going on in kind of diagnosis is the scientific ideologies of the late 19th century, Darwinism, which told us where we came from, Marxism, which told us where we were going and had a vision of a utopian future, Freudianism, which painted a picture of what to do about human guilt, essentially replaced the Judeo-Christian foundation of the West, and Judeo-Christian religion answered all those same questions. And now, post-19th century, there's been an intellectual consensus in the elite academy in favor of what we call scientific materialism or scientific naturalism. And what we're seeing in the streets, in public policy advocacy, is the implications of that worldview starting to trickle out into policy. But it's coming from a deeper worldview consensus that dominates the Western academy. But that consensus is in turn based on 19th century theories that are no longer empirically valid. There are good reasons to doubt all of those theories. So what we're looking to achieve is a shift in worldview by challenging the alleged scientific foundations of that larger worldview, which is giving rise to some of these really extreme political and social ideologies.
And let me just give you real quick, if I may, an example of the harm that this can cause. There's a small fishing village in Alaska called King's Cove. And King's Cove is in an isolated area. It's mainly Native Americans. And they have an airport, but it's not one that can fly in all weather. And so when they have a medical emergency in their town, which is about 1,000 people, sometimes people have died because of inclement weather. They've been unable to fly to a hospital for people to be taken care of. 20 miles away, there is another village with an all-weather airport. And what King's Cove wanted to do was cut a gravel road from their village or their town to this other town that had an all-weather airport. And it would be gravel. And they were even willing to, this was in a protected area owned and controlled by the federal government, they were willing to take some of their acreage and give it in exchange for the right to cut through this road. And showing what happens, there was a visit by the Obama administration Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell. And she listened to people talk about the difficulty and the fear, of course, they'd have if in the middle of a time where they couldn't fly, somebody had a burst appendix. I mean, what are you going to do for these people? You have to get them to a place where there could be surgery. They have a medical clinic, but they don't have a full hospital. And Jewell rejected the road, saying it would jeopardize waterfowl in the refuge. And this is what the congressman said that was there. Quote, She stood up in the gymnasium and told the kids, "I've listened to your stories. Now I have to listen to the animals." Anti-human. Real harm to living and breathing human beings who could die from this decision to cut a road that would cause no intrinsic damage to the area because they have to listen to the animals. The animals didn't care, and the animals wouldn't have been hurt. But when you get this kind of worldview, you end up discarding people as actually sometimes having less value.
Ideas have consequences.
You've just heard highlights of a panel event co-hosted by Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation discussing the real threats to science in America. For more on these topics, check out our written coverage of the March for Science at The Stream. You'll find it at stream.org/tag/ScienceWeek2017. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.